I'm pleased to be following Dr. Zucker's presentation, actually, because some of the data that I'll be presenting is similar to what she's been presenting. And I wanted to put in a plug for a presentation I'll be giving on Wednesday that looks at HPV vaccination analysis based on data from our Sentinel Sites project. The presentation I'll be giving today, like Dr. Zucker's, illustrates the potential of immunization information systems to evaluate how immunization policies are implemented. And specifically today, I'll describe a study focused on the meningococcal conjugate vaccine. And I'd also like to acknowledge the contributions of the co-authors, Drs. Angela Kelligar and Robin Curtis, from my center's Immunization Services Division. Our study objective was to evaluate trends in vaccination against meningococcal disease in the context of recommendations by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice and evolving vaccine supply issues during the study period between January 2005 and March 2007. This is an outline of my presentation and this background to describing the study. I'll provide an overview of the policy history of the meningococcal conjugate vaccine, abbreviated from now on as MCV4. I'll also provide some limited information from the National Immunization Survey TEEN. And finally, as context for the study, I'll briefly describe the Immunization Information System Sentinel Site project, which served as the data source for our evaluation. Further, I will present methods, preliminary results, and strengths and limitations of our study. In the end, preliminary conclusions will be discussed. The MCV4 vaccine was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in January 2005 for use among persons 11 to 55 years of age. In February 2005, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices voted to recommend the vaccine. The recommendations included routine vaccination of persons 11 to 12 years of age, vaccination before high school entry, routine vaccination for college freshmen living in dormitories, and other populations at increased risk, and use of the meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine, or MPSV4, as an alternative if MCV4 were unavailable. Returning to our vaccine policy history slide, after the events in January and February, MCV4 was added to the CDC federal purchase contract with the manufacturer. In May 2005, the ACIP recommendations were published. In May 2006, ACIP recommended deferral of vaccination for persons aged 11 to 12 years due to issues with MCV4 supply and demand. In October 2006, supply improved, and the ACIP recommended resumption of vaccination at 11 to 12 years. For vaccines recommended for adolescents, including MCV4, coverage data are limited. One source of data that should be noted is the TEEN module of the National Immunization Survey, or NIS-TEEN. This random digit dialing telephone survey was conducted for the first time during October 2006 through February 2007 to provide national vaccination coverage estimates only. Parents or guardians of adolescents aged 13 to 17 years completed 5,468 interviews, resulting in a household response rate of 56.2%. Provider-reported vaccination records were returned and available for 2,882 adolescents, representing 52.7% of adolescents with completed household interviews. According to these records, for this national sample, MCV4 was received by 11.7% of adolescents aged 13 to 17 years. For this study's analysis, we utilized data from immunization information systems participating in CDC's IIS Sentinel Sites project. States and cities receiving CDC immunization grant funds received supplemental grant funds to participate in this project, and New York City will be a participant of this project beginning this year. So it's interesting, I'm following Dr. Zucker's talk. The project assesses vaccination coverage quarterly for persons less than 19 years of age, and all grantees implemented data quality improvement plans. Although the state IIS collects data from the entire state, the Sentinel Site area of study or evaluation consisted of a geographic area of contiguous counties that had high levels of provider participation, both public and private, and most of the children enrolled in the IIS. And from 2004 through 2007, the project had six grantees participating, which included Arizona, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, Oregon, and the District of Columbia. The project performs routine assessments of child and adolescent vaccination administration patterns and special studies like the one that I will be describing to you today. As you can see, the sites were very diverse. For example, Michigan included all of the state in its Sentinel site area except for the Detroit area. That is the third row down from the table. And they had almost 1 million adolescents in the Sentinel site area. In comparison to the rural areas of Minnesota, which is the fourth row down, I don't have a pointer here, with a Sentinel site area of 16,000 adolescents. Arizona focused on the northern counties, they're the first row, and that area had a larger representation of Native Americans, and D.C. included the eastern part of the district with its large Medicaid population. The six Sentinel sites reported MCV4 and MPSV4 doses administered to persons, 11 to 18 years of age, from January to 2005 to March 2007. This preliminary analysis focused on three periods of interest. Period one, which is defined as January 2005 through April 2006, which covered the time of licensure to the pre-shortage months. Period two, defined as May 2006 through October 2006, which covered the shortage recommendations. Period three, defined as November 2006 through March 2007, which covered the time frame after the shortage recommendations ended due to increased vaccine supply. The denominator used was reported in the Sentinel site's quarter one 2007 report, which collected data through February 15th, 2007. This denominator represented children 11 to 18 years of age enrolled in the IIS and residing in the IIS Sentinel site's geographic area. It's notable that the Sentinel sites generally have about 90% of their adolescent population enrolled in the IIS, and that for some geographic areas, census estimates aren't available. For these reasons, we decided that this was the best available denominator. And since 80% of the doses administered during this project period came from Michigan, we used this denominator to calculate doses per 1,000 persons and vaccination coverage for the sites. Data analysis focused on doses administered by month, recipient age, public and private, provider type, and the vaccine doses by number and type. This slide illustrates the pattern of the average MCV4 doses administered during the study period by age group and month among all of the sites. On the x-axis, we have month of administration, and on the y-axis, we have the number of doses per 1,000 persons. Again, since Michigan included such a large population in its Sentinel site area, we averaged the doses administered per 1,000 persons across the sites to prevent Michigan's data from overcoming the data from the other sites. And although after the initial ACIP recommendations, we can see an increase in vaccination coverage, especially among the 16 to 18-year-olds. The green line there. Find it. Yeah. When ACIP recommended deferral of doses to the 11 to 12-year-olds, we see the average doses administered in this age group decrease while the other age groups increase. The patterns related to the different age groups appear to be converging at the end of period three. I don't know if my pointer's working right over there. Suggesting that the providers and immunization programs were resuming administration across the recommended age groups. Now let's talk about vaccination coverage estimates. This slide describes MCV4 coverage in 11 to 18-year-olds by time period. On the x-axis, we have all of the Sentinel sites, and the y-axis has their percentage of vaccination coverage. As shown in the note below, we again used a site-specific denominator from the quarter one 2007 Sentinel site report to calculate each site's vaccination coverage for each of the three time periods. For period one, data as of April 2006 is shown in yellow. Period two is in orange, and period three is in blue. And looking across the time periods, cumulative MCV4 coverage increased. Of note, even during the shortage shown by period two in orange, vaccination coverage was increasing. We can see that coverage estimates varied by site, but as of period three, coverage ranged from 3.4% in Minnesota to as high as 10.8% in Oregon. The average among all the sites was 6.8%. Similar to the previous slide, we calculated the vaccination coverage by age group. Four of the six sites had higher coverage in their 16 to 18-year-old populations, but DC had the higher percentage of its 11 to 12-year-olds vaccinated. To better observe the trends across all the sites, this slide and subsequent graphs use number of doses per 1,000 persons in its calculations and is represented on the y-axis. Age at vaccination is represented on the x-axis. This slide focuses on period one and is the first of three slides that will illustrate how sites responded to evolving ACIP recommendations and the vaccine shortage. Doses administered varied by site. For example, if you look at DC with the pink columns, you'll notice that there, you'll notice that their 11 to 12 year olds are getting almost 40 doses per 1,000 persons in that age group, while the older age groups are getting less than half that amount. This up here compared to there and there. In contrast, we see Michigan in the purple with little differences between the doses in their youngest and oldest age groups. So here's Michigan in the purple, and here's them here, and then here. This is all in contrast to the administration pattern we see in period two that occurred during the vaccine shortage recommendations. Across all the sites, we see a shift from the 11 to 12 year olds to the 16 to 18 year olds age group. After the shortage recommendations end in period three, we see the sites more or less resuming to the administration pattern seen in period one. This slide illustrates the total doses administered in the public sector, such as public health departments, federally qualified health centers, et cetera, and the private sector will be described in the next slide. In this slide, you will notice two peaks in coverage which occurred during the summer months of 2005 and 2006. As we can see, August 2006 was the peak month for vaccination and occurred during the vaccine shortage period right over here. The blue line represents total doses with about three doses per 1,000 persons in the entire adolescent population. We should note here that the 16 to 18-year-olds represented with the green line right over here had about two-thirds of the doses administered during the month. This represents about 3,200 of the 3,900 doses given to all ages. It's interesting to compare the total doses administered in the public and private sectors. And in this slide, we focused on the private sector. We again see seasonal peaks in the summer months due to increased demand because of school entry, summer camps, and sports physical requirements. Overall, the private sector administered almost twice as much as the public sector. Using August 2006 as our example again, right over here, we can see that while about six doses per 1,000 total persons were given during that month, about half went to the 16 to 18-year-olds. This comes to about 2,900 doses for the 16 to 18-year-olds of the total 5,700 doses administered by private providers during this month of the shortage period. This last results slide illustrates the pattern of MCV4 doses administered averaged across the sites for MCV4 versus MPSV4. And aside from a small seasonal peak in August 2006, the numbers of doses administered of MPSV4 has remained low over this study period, while MCV4 has increased. One important strength of the study is that the data set includes data from over 1.2 million enrolled adolescents. Some limitations include our using a proxy denominator from the Q1 2007 quarterly report for the number of enrolled adolescents for calculations that include doses administered in 2005 through 2006. We also cannot directly compare our coverage numbers to the NIST MCV4 estimates because their survey only included adolescents 13 to 17 years, while our numbers include children 11 to 18 years. And the NIST also produced a national estimate, while our numbers are locally based. Our results indicate that vaccination coverage is low but increasing. We can see that vaccination coverage varied among the age groups and sites, that administration patterns were generally consistent with the ACIP routine and shortage-related recommendations. We can also note that that during the shortage period of period two, the public sector appears to have focused on vaccinating 16 to 18-year-olds using two-thirds of their available vaccine supply to vaccinate this group, while the private sector also seems to have prioritized the older age group during the same time. They allocated about 50% of their available and greater supply. We can also note the seasonality of vaccine administration patterns for this vaccine, with peaks during the summer months prior to school entry, despite the ACIP recommendation for year-round vaccination. I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues at the Sentinel site states, Arizona, Michigan, Washington, D.C., Minnesota, Montana, and Oregon, and my colleagues at the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Diana. We now have time for some discussion and questions. If we could have the house lights brought up and the spotlights brought down, I can see where there are people standing at the microphones.
This question's for, sorry, I'm losing my voice, Dr. Zucker. It was amazing to see the uptake of your Tdap with the school mandate. Did you consider meningococcal vaccine for the Board of Health regulation, or was it not put forth, or was it your opposition to meningococcal requirements for sixth grade?
Well, my first answer is that the New York City school requirements that are implemented are actually done at the state level, and we haven't yet chosen to make new requirements at the city level. There is some discussion, I know, at the state level whether there should be a meningococcal conjugate requirement, and we'll see what happens this legislative session.
My question is for Dorothy. That was a great presentation, Dorothy. Did you use reminder recall in your project, and did you use standing orders, and how did those factors affect if you did use them?
We do use the reminder recalls. That's an important piece for us, and I have clerical staff that actually do that, as well as our Medicaid health plans assist us in doing that too. And as far as standing orders, yes, what we do is the nurses evaluate the immunization status for those patients, and they actually put that right into their note in the EMR, and then the resident requirement is to go over that and make sure that it's up to date. What we found before we started having the nurses do that is that the residents weren't as sure of the standards for immunization as the nurses were. So now it's a two-part process. The nurse evaluates it, then the resident comes behind them and evaluates it, and then looks to see if there's any medical reason as to why that patient shouldn't get anything for that day, and then writes the orders for the nurse, and then the nurse administers what's been ordered.
Dorothy, I think you talked about a transfer of data maybe first, I don't remember which was going to happen first, but between the electronic medical records and MICR, and then a two-way exchange between. How will that be funded? Is that something that you're taking on in your system?
Correct.
Okay.
We're looking at having our EMR data go to the MICR system, and we put money into our budget to do that, and we'll pay for that. And then my goal is to have it a two-way data. I find that what happens is the time that the nurses and the clerical staff take to input the data, you know, we could be seeing many, many more patients, bringing in additional dollars to our system.
Okay. Scott?
Scott Hamster, Indian Health Service, Arizona. Dr. Zucker, I'm intrigued by your BFC ordering link to your actual doses reported, and wondered if you could just provide a little detail on how easy or difficult that was to do.
Where to start? I think, some of the architects who actually did the work are also in the audience. Perhaps we can hook you up afterwards. I think it was really, you know, when I became program manager in New York City, one of the things that really amazed me was that we had this VFC database of the providers, and there were VFC PIN numbers, and then there was a CIR database and CIR facility codes, and they never talked, and there was really no cross-fertilization, which honestly wasn't acceptable. And there was an incredible investment, which took about 6 months to a year, to really match those data sets so that we actually were, we can really link VFC distribution to what was coming into the CIR. And it was a tremendous amount of work. I mean, we called providers, we tried to verify all the information, make sure that who this provider said they were really was that doc in the registry and so forth. When we decided to link accountability, and I think previously there had been some resistance, the idea that if you somehow hold back vaccine, you'll affect coverage levels among kids. So, we had tried many different ways to improve reporting to the registry that really didn't work. So we did vet the accountability with our local stakeholders and particularly our childhood coalition. And then we actually sent a registered letter to every provider in the registry in January telling them that this was going to happen, that they had 9 months to improve their reporting, and that we were there for them to help them with the technical aspects. We then sent them a letter in June, their first sort of their doses administered report, to give them a heads up. Well, the implementation date was September 1st. So again, they had a long 9-month timeline, and then we gave them another letter in June that said, this is coming, this is where you are. If you're not where you want to be, you know, call us. We're here to help you and provide technical assistance. We put together an algorithm in advance so that we knew, you know, how much the docs were going to be cut. So we actually gave them a pass. It was 80% and higher accountability of vaccine. We wouldn't cut their orders. And then again, there were percentage cuts, you know, from as it went lower. So if they were reporting 50% of their doses, they got a 30% cut and so forth. And we've been monitoring that to make sure, you know, that again, they didn't just start ordering more frequently. And so we've been able to catch any of that as well. But really, you can see what happened and the impact on reporting, and I think it's really worked. And the other thing we did when we sold this to the providers, basically they were filling out this incredibly horrible paper copy doses administered report that was one aggregate data that was really not useful to the program, and it was time consuming to the provider. So we said, why report twice, once to the registry and once to the VFC program? We're going to help you out and let's report once. And I think it really overall, you know, was a big success in that we've gotten very positive feedback from the provider community.
Yes.
A question for Dorothy. I'm Kyle Enger from Michigan. And congratulations on your achievement.
Thank you.
I wanted to just go a little bit beyond what you talked about. I was curious if from your much increased focus on immunizations of your patients, did you see a collateral effect in the immunization of your staff, say for influenza?
I missed the last part.
Due to the increased focus on immunizations, did you see an increase in immunizations of your staff for influenza?
Actually, we did. Two things happened to us during this period. When the Katrina effort happened in Louisiana, we ended up receiving one of our EMR, our ER physicians, and I coordinated the effort for a lot of the Louisiana people to come into our community. We received over 700 of those patients. What we realized at that time was that this was an emergency. We had prepared for it, but we had prepared for immunization. So we sent our staff, the hospital staff, to the Katrina effort without any knowledge of what their immunization status was. So what that pointed out to us was that we needed an additional registry for our healthcare providers. So what we did was we worked with MCR, and we now have an occupational health site. All of our staff are now in that registry. It's all part of the MCR registry, and they're there so that if we ever have another emergency effort, our staff are right there, and we'll be able to know, sending them out there, that they're protected adequately. That to me was very, very important. It's also very important for me in the clinic because of you all know that you have many patients and families who, for many reasons, don't want to get immunized. So it was very important for me to know the status of our healthcare workers. And both of our hospitals this past year made it a mandate that all healthcare providers had flu vaccines. So since we're cooperative with them, we implemented that also, and it was much easier to monitor who was still needing flu vaccines for us.
And what coverage did you achieve in your healthcare workers?
100%. You couldn't go into the hospitals if you weren't immunized. They lost their privileges. So
it's of some interest, not necessarily using a registry for the purpose, but Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle, a very large healthcare system, implemented mandatory immunization of healthcare workers as a condition of employment, and have achieved 95%+ immunization against influenza for 2 years in a row. Last question, Mary Beth.
This is just a follow-up for Dorothy. I asked you about standing orders. The nurses were just choosing what they needed and then following up with the docs, and the docs were actually writing the orders. Is that correct?
Yes and no. They put in what they say that the patient needs to have. They put that right in their note under immunizations required. If it's an RN, that RN can go ahead, like for a nursing visit, the RN can go ahead and implement those orders.
Okay.
Our MA and LPN staff cannot.
I apologize because I forget. In New York, it has to be RNs giving the shots. Well, we have LPNs under direction, but the RNs give the shot.
Correct.
We don't have MAs giving shots in New York.
I'm sorry?
We don't have MAs in New York giving shots.
Okay, we do in Michigan.
Okay.
That's part of their scope of practice.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You're very welcome.
I'd like to give a round of applause to our presenters because I think it was a very good session.